Okay, we're on. All right, so are you all system-y now? You feeling all system-y? This is a new term we're making up just for this session, because we have to get the word system in somewhere in the session, so we've done it. Hi, I'm Tony Macklin. I'm with the Roy Hunt Foundation. I'm also active in a giving circle in Pittsburgh called the Awesome Foundation Pittsburgh, and we'll dive into that a little bit with some examples. This session is designed on a couple levels. One is we're going to start off with a little bit of information to sort of just give you some context on what we mean by this issue of social giving or new giving and how it's going to become a wave that we're going to have to pay attention to in the family philanthropy market. Second, we're going to give a couple case studies and talk about how some family foundations have worked with the issue. We're going to turn it over to you at your tables and ask you to think about how this kind of work may affect your family. And would people be excited or would they be threatened or would it be fun or not for your family? We're going to take all your information back in and blog it and publish it, so we have some information for you to take back to your families as well as we can take back to the field. And then we'll grab any other burning questions you have. Your first assignment was to put questions on the whiteboard. Everybody was too scared to do that. So there's cards at your table if you want to fill out some questions that pop up to you along the way. We've got 60 minutes. We may not get to all of them during the 60 minutes, but we're going to hang out for a half hour afterwards, and feel free to grab us after that. But your other assignment was to look at this sheet up here and says, how much do you know? What's your personal experience with crowdfunding and giving circles and sort of small philanthropy? So how many people are really experienced with it? Do you have a green card in your hand? Okay, just a few. How many people have like heard the terms but don't know much about it yet? A lot of orange cards, or yellow cards. And then how many people are here like, what the hell are these people talking about? All right, good. So
they're clustered mostly.
They're clustered in the back. This is the really like, what's going on
so
table.
That's
so we will be upfront that a lot of this is still emerging and a lot of it is new. And so we're going to give you our best sense of what the market looks like and what's going on. There are a whole lot of questions that are yet unanswered. So this is probably round one of a conversation. Nathan and Aaron and I are going to continue this on our Twitter feeds and on our blogs and everything, so the council can keep up with it. So make sure you do as well. Here's our Twitter handles, if you want to be tweetering with us, as my board chair called it. And you can follow along with it. So I've got two people who are our actual content experts with me. I'm the person who's the geezer in family philanthropy and is playing a little bit in this field right now. Nathaniel James has a veteran history in both marketing and communications, as well as philanthropy and philanthropy advising, and now has his own consulting firm blending all that together called PhilanthroGeek. You can look him up on the web and follow this whole trend of small giving, social giving, crowdfunding, giving circles, the whole kit and caboodle, and he'll be sort of the new central resource for you. Aaron Barnes is with IOBI in our backyard, a relatively new nonprofit, 4 years old, piloted in New York, now going national, coming to your cities soon. And IOBI is a living case study of a charity who's really thinking about all of this and enacting it and using it in ways that engage everyday people in giving in their communities, including low-income people giving back to their own communities and doing that online for some of the first times. So she'll talk a little bit about what that feels like. So we're going to turn a lot of this over quickly to them. But we'll start with this premise. And our premise is that this social giving landscape, this new giving landscape, the terms are sort of interchangeable, take up these components. Nathaniel and Aaron will walk you through a little bit about what they're thinking about in terms of what does this all mean and some of the examples on it.
So I first want to start off by thanking Tony for inviting us and for welcoming us into the space of kind of traditional and organized philanthropy. It's very exciting. And the conference so far has been wonderful, the people that I've met. So I'm very happy to be here and look forward to hearing from all of you. So I guess the question that I want to propose and offer some answers to are why would a traditional or organized philanthropy organization get into any of this? And why a family or community foundation would? And so there's sort of a theoretical piece, and I have some of it, and Aaron has some of it, and then we have some case studies. And there's kind of two areas that I want to talk about, is accessing wisdom. Who here has heard of the phrase wisdom of crowds? Okay, great. Well, it's a great book, and it sort of taps into the idea of crowdsourcing. It's a great starting place for that. But the idea is, especially with the internet, that we can tap into the wisdom and intelligence of hundreds or thousands of people to solve problems. And there will always be more of that intelligence outside of our organizations than within. So what are we going to do about that? And how it's really working in both, I think both the crowdfunding and this small giving circle model are really two things. So people with ideas, entrepreneurs, activists, creatives, are beginning to bypass the traditional philanthropic pipeline, right? Like either they don't have patience because they're an entrepreneur and they want to get started and they don't want to go through the long process of building relationships and grant application compliance and things like that. Or they're really grassroots and they don't know yet if their ideas are worthy of you, of worthy of foundations. There's a huge intimidation factor. And so really grounded solutions are coming to the fore. They are grounded in deep community knowledge and participation, either at a local level or deep community of practice participation. And they're going to the Kickstarters and the IOBs and the Donors Choose, well, and teach, you know, education Donors Choose. And they're going to the Awesome Foundation and small giving circles on the local level to get their funding, to get started. And they don't know how to find you, but the online tools are making them easier and easier for you to find them. So if you have a program area, you know, I'm asking foundations, you know, why aren't you, if it's environment, you know, why aren't you looking at, you know, searching environment on Kickstarter and Rocket Hub and Indiegogo, which are three well-known crowdfunding platforms. Because on the flip side, those projects and ideas and solutions are being vetted by hundreds and thousands of people. And it's so much stronger than, you know, a Pepsi refresh challenge, you know, where people are asked to like something on Facebook or, you know, sort of vote up an idea. Are folks generally familiar with these online giving challenges? Because people are opening their wallet and valuing it at $5 and $25 and $50 and $500 at a time. So not only are they vetting the individual or the small organization that's offering the solution, whether they're trustworthy, whether they can really follow through, you know, they're doing the kind of assessment that you all do all the time of potential grantees. They're doing that, but they're also saying, this is valuable enough to me that I'm gonna put cash down. So it's not just, yeah, I like it, and then I forget about it. And once they put that cash down, even if it's only $5, they're invested. And they want to see the project, they want to see the campaign succeed, then they want to see the project succeed. And that, I think, really comes to the second side that I really care about here is crowdfunding and small giving and giving circles as engines of social capital, right? So you may think, okay, if someone gets a $1,000 grant or they raise maybe $3,000 on a Kickstarter or an IOB, you know, you're looking at, even at family foundations, you're looking at larger grants for larger impacts. But that $3,000 is coming with hundreds of potential volunteers and ambassadors and people who are going to check in, take their message forward, evangelize to broader and broader networks of people. And so the question and challenge to you is that if that's exciting to you, if you want to figure out how your philanthropy is going to access that kind of intelligence and help your grantees access that kind of capital flow, even when it's kind of small and can seem, you know, not worth doing, what can we do about that? And we have some examples where people are starting to do that.
So just before Aaron jumps in, just to make sure everything's clear, the handout that we have is going to be online tomorrow, so there's a lot more background materials for you to dive into on this. They were trying to be green and not print things out, but you're really looking at sort of two buckets of things going on, sometimes that put together. You've got crowdfunding, where folks give together over the internet. Maybe people know Donors Choose. So if you've heard of Donors Choose, where you can send money to a teacher project, that's one classic example. Kickstarter is the example for products and projects. IOB, which Aaron's going to talk about, is an example for my environmental project. So lots of small gifts, sometimes medium-sized to large-sized gifts, combined together, lots of relationships to sort of drive that. The other bucket of things are giving circles that tend to be under the radar of traditional philanthropy. So there's nationally the Community Investment Network, which is for folks who are giving typically smaller amounts in their giving circle, and lots of it's driven by ethnic minorities and ethnic sort of caucuses around issues.
And women.
And women. Yeah. There's lots of women ones. And so there's women's giving circles. There's ethnic giving circles. There's local giving circles that are based around a particular issue. And then there's ones that are sort of off the charts, sort of creative. And this is the example of the Awesome Foundation, which is a national network of groups that each put in, each groups of 10 people that put in $100 each and give $1,000 out to something that's really cool in their community, regardless of what kind of sector it's in. So it could be a person, it could be a nonprofit, it could be a business, could be a social change cause of any kind. But it's just sort of like, it's that attachment that Nathan talked about. They want a one-to-one attachment. They see something doing really good stuff. They want to jump on it right now. So two concepts that were sort of put together into this sort of concept of social giving and new giving that you want to keep in mind.
Thank you, yeah. You know, there's one little thing we didn't plan, but I just want to say this stuff is fun for people too, yeah. And it's joyful. And, you know, I know I come from a nonprofit background and, you know, a social impact background, and we can be also terribly earnest, you know, like we're going to talk about scaling impact and, you know, all this terminology, and it's makes it inaccessible to everyday folks who want to see solutions as well. And we're finding out more and more that people who give, they're receiving biochemical signals that make them happier and healthier, right? So if you want to make giving fun and joyful and have a strategy around joy, this is something to look at. And so it's sort of a new thing I've been thinking about a lot, and I forgot to mention it. Maybe that's a good handover.
Well, no, yeah. I just wanted to bring up one other thing on the theoretical side of it. Which is that I think that there's broadly a lot of the new giving happens on digital platforms, and there's a lot of really robust digital tools out there that can power a lot of different types of offline action. And I think that online giving can be a first step in that, and crowdfunding sort of plays into that.
Yeah. Who here has given to a crowdfunding campaign? Okay. Do you remember the last 24 hours while they were trying to make their goal? Right? Do you remember that feeling and being and participating and bugging out all your friends on Facebook and things? So people really, the cavalry will come in, and it really feels like a community effort when people are doing crowdfunding, for one example. Mm-hmm. So,
should I talk about IOB now, or
yeah,
do you want to?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm one of three co-founders of a crowd resourcing platform called IOB. The three of us met when we were at the Yale School of Forestry together. They don't teach web technology and development at the Yale School of Forestry. So I definitely came into this world definitely by accident. So IOB's name comes from the opposite of NIMBY. We're all about local action, and all the projects on IOB are citizen-led and neighbor-funded. We call IOB a crowd resourcing platform, combining the ideas of crowdfunding and resource organizing. So similar to what I was just talking about before, I think that there's a lot of opportunities for people to become more deeply engaged in their communities, and making a donation to something can often be just one part of that. So on IOB, people can donate to a project in their communities. They can also sign up to volunteer. They can share ideas in a like-minded community. And we're trying to build a network of people who are all trying to make their neighborhoods work better. We're most closely modeled after DonorsChoose.org. So if you're familiar with that, you have a pretty good sense of how IOB works. It looks like a typical crowdfunding site where people have a thermometer of funding goals that they're trying to reach, but it's also tied to a place. So there's a map that shows where the project is, and you can search for nearby projects. So our goals also have to do with deepening people's civic engagement and their political awareness of environmental issues in their neighborhood. So I was going to tell a quick story just to illustrate how IOB works and some of the things that I think are pretty interesting. And then I'm going to tell a case study that we did with the Jack Johnson Ohana Foundation this past September. So the story that I want to tell you is it's actually a pretty typical type of story, but it's one of my favorite ones. About a year and a half ago, we got a project on IOB called 596 Acres, and the group was trying to raise $324 to print some posters and hang them on the fences of vacant lots around Brooklyn. They raised the $324 in a single day, I think in like 5 hours. They hung up the posters that basically said, there's a lot in your life, you can do something with it if you want to. Which actually wasn't very true because the lots were locked up and owned by the city government. But they had the contact information of the city agency on the back of the posters. So one day, Tia Jackson, who lived on Halsey Street in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood of Brooklyn, who had been living there for 26 years, looking at this vacant lot that had been vacant her entire life, saw this poster that dramatically changed the way that she saw this vacant lot. And she called the number, and she decided that she wanted to make it a community space. Then about 27 other people did the same thing with vacant lots in their neighborhood, and the city agency decided that they should probably let people access these lots. So they gave them 6 months to do it. About 19 of these groups went ahead and started crowdfunding campaigns on IOB. All of them were raising between $1,000 and $3,000 to start projects that were either, you know, community gardens, urban farms, just regular play spaces or places for kids to come and learn. That was a year and a half ago. There's 19 new farms in Brooklyn, and now posters are up in all five boroughs. It's kind of an interesting story for us also because they were some of the largest, most well-connected set of people that were able to respond after Hurricane Sandy. So a lot of IOB project leaders, obviously because of their orientation towards environmental work in cities, were actively doing some relief efforts right after Sandy. But the ones that were part of the 596 Acres network were all really strong and had deep connections to the neighborhoods, which I thought was really interesting. But this is a very typical type of project on IOB where they're trying to raise a small amount of funding. The groups were not C3s. They're volunteer-led. People were doing them in their free time, and they were very, very tied to their neighborhood base. Some of the things that IOB cares a lot about have to do with neighborhood cohesion and proving community support for an idea or a new thing. So Nathan was talking a little bit about how you have this set of people crowdfunding ideas, and you're having millions of people vet them all the time. So IOB can track where donors live towards the projects, and you can actually sort of prove community support for an idea. There's a new type of project that we're seeing a lot of called tactical urbanism, where people are testing out short-term demonstration projects in their areas, and you can actually just see the pins on the map where the clusters of donors live within blocks of the site where it's happening. And you can see a lot of community support. A few years ago, we started working with the Jack Johnson Ohana Foundation, and we were one of a group of people that was just sort of a small nonprofit set of people tabling at one of their events. And I write about this in long detail on PhilanthroGeek, so you can check out the whole story.
PhilanthroGeek.com. It's a great article.
So we started working with them a couple of years ago, and they actually encouraged us to run the second ever match campaign that we ran on IOB. So they would put in their philanthropic support, and then we would have Citizen Philanthropy match it on IOB. Over a couple of years, we've tested this out a few times. I'd be happy to tell you more detail about it. But we've been studying these pretty closely, and so we finally got to the point where we asked the Jack Johnson Ohana Foundation for support again, and we had a really good idea of how we wanted to run the campaign. We decided we wanted to be unrestricted and support all projects on IOB. We found that projects that we're all fundraising during a match campaign together, we're able to reinforce the fundraising campaign because they had tied in social networks. And so the same things were popping up on Facebook and Twitter. So even though the Johnson Ohana Charitable Foundation only really wanted to fund schools and gardens, they decided to go ahead and support all projects unrestricted. They just asked that we specifically tried to recruit more school garden projects than normal during this campaign. We also asked that we could run this campaign in a limited time frame. We wanted it to be a single day, but decided to do it between 1 and 3 days. They had no idea really why we wanted to do this, and I'll tell you more about that in a second, but we insisted that this was the most effective way for us to run this. And so what we found is that when we run match campaigns, we usually run them dollar for dollar and then match them up to a certain amount, like $25. And we know that the donations that come in at the beginning of the campaign are much higher than the ones at the end. So at the beginning of the campaign on day one, donations came in at $1.90 per dollar matched. But on the third day of the campaign, there were only $1.20 per every dollar matched. So we try and limit all of our campaign matches that way.
So the short time is to maximize the
Amount that you can leverage on a dollar.
That's right. So
we were able to raise something, I think it's like $48,000 in 3 days. There was, I can't remember now how many donors there were. There was a bunch of projects that were fully funded. About 13 of them were fully funded, and about 50 projects got support from the Johnson Ohana Charitable Foundation this way. And they were able to support a ton of different projects, and the majority of them were school garden projects. But the one thing that I wanted to bring up here is this is an emerging field, and so I think there's a lot of space here to try and innovate this, and I think that it requires a lot of people working together. So the Johnson Ohana Charitable Foundation funded almost an identical grant also to Donors Choose, which works in schools. So they asked Donors Choose to run this match campaign for garden classroom projects at the same time, but Donors Choose ran the campaign completely differently. They did it very, very long period, so it's actually still going on. They had the same amount of funding, and they launched it on April 22nd, and it's still running. And I don't know if they're actually promoting it directly to people. So as soon as they're finished, I'm going to ask Charles for the details on that report. But I think
the founder.
Charles Best is the founder of Donors Choose, sorry. But, you know, I think that there is a really interesting thing that the Johnson Ohana Charitable Foundation is doing here, where they're actually, like, seeding almost identical types of grants in two different organizations and seeing how
it's
they
like
play
A-B
out.
Like testing and funding.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thanks.
I think that's really important. There's a theme there is that because, on especially with the online platforms, and even Awesome Foundation is essentially an online platform because we have our grant, our intake is online and our output is online. You can start to look at this data and have data-driven fundraising strategies, which is just, you know, the future, right? Like, why are we not doing more of this? Mm-hmm. So thanks for bringing that up. That's amazing.
Yeah.
You have another example right here in the crowd?
Yeah, I do. So we wanted to show you some case studies of going from small to big and partnering and or what a you know what small fundraising can do. I had this whole other case, and then it just so happens Tony and I know each other from the Awesome Foundation. So I founded the Seattle chapter, and you founded the Pittsburgh chapter, and we met at MIT at the Awesome Summit this summer. And Tony also backed a prototype project of mine on a crowdfunding campaign. So we have this Awesome Foundation connection. Well, last night at the opening party, who were you at the opening party? Raise your hands. Oh, goodness. So, well, somewhere in town, somewhere in the conference, we've got, there's this like design. I'll let her speak to it. But I walked up and I said, oh, what is this? And it comes to find out it's the Smithsonian is here with this really cool project. But the person behind it was an Awesome Foundation Seattle grantee. And her name is Michelle, I'm sorry, Del Carlo. And so I just wanted her to come up and kind of tell a little bit of that story of what a small grant can mean.
You mean a lot.
Yeah, we've got a,
use this one, we'll turn
a mobile and a stand. Yeah.
There you go.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Sorry, I'm turning my back to you guys.
That's okay. Please do.
So can everyone hear me? Okay. If I'm too soft, just let me know. It was awesome to meet you last night. It was so serendipitous. And so I guess what I really want to talk to you all today is about kind of the impact that a very small amount of money can make, basically what it did for me in my life. It's been awesome. So I think before I applied for the Awesome Grant, if you told me that I would be sitting in a cafe and handed $1,000 in cash by someone you'd never met before, I would have been like, you're crazy. So what happened for me was I was in Seattle. I went to the University of Washington, and I was in the Museum Studies Master's Program. I also have a certificate in nonprofit management. And what I developed was something called the Pop-Up Museum. And it was kind of my way of solving this problem in the museum field, which is we want to more deeply engage with our communities, but we don't know how to do that. So what I kind of came up with this was this formula that said, okay, let's take some empty space, let's invite people to bring their own objects for which they'll write their own labels, all based on a theme, and then when they get there, the whole point is just to have conversation. So I have had pop-ups on theme of adoption, I've had pop-ups on the theme of handmade, and it's this very conceptual idea. I was operating way outside the accepted museum field, way outside the kind of sphere of professional, accepted professional kind of practice. And so I went to a conference and I met someone who'd won an Awesome Award in Seattle, and she said, you know, what you're doing sounds like an awesome idea. and so she really encouraged me to apply, and I thought about it, and I kind of thought, okay, that sounds really cool. So I applied, not thinking I would get the funding. And then I did in June 2012, so just this past June, I was awarded the Awesome Award. And I guess the way that it actually changed the trajectory of both of my career and of the museum field in general, actually, is that what I was doing was so radical that people kind of were looking at me. I didn't think I would get funding from anybody else to continue doing it. And what the $1,000 actually allowed me to do was to leverage both the backing, so I could say, hey, these people are actually interested in me. These people are actually vetting my idea. It's actually a thing that's, you know, not just operating way outside the norm, but it also allowed me to have some capacity to work with someone else, and we're now developing a toolkit that's going to be freely open and accessible for other museums who want to create their own pop-up museums in their own communities. So that happened. I also then got the job at the Smithsonian, so that happened, which is awesome. and I really don't believe that would have happened if I hadn't gotten the award, because I'm working in kind of an experimental part of the museum, and so that really showed them that I was willing to take risks, to go in different angles, to kind of be a little bit more innovative, and so that was part of it as well. And I actually, another thing about the Awesome Foundation that I hope people start to realize, or about this crowdfunding thing, is that it's actually given me a community. I talk to the people in the Awesome Foundation, or Awesome Awards Seattle, quite a bit about how I can keep on doing the pop-up museum, even though I'm now working full-time for the Smithsonian. I talk to them about how do I write my blog, how do I make sure that the toolkit gets pushed out, and kind of all of these things. So it's not just about the money, it's also about the network. And so I think just overall, I've had a really good experience, and even though it was only $1,000, it really kind of changed a lot, so.
Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And if I may add just a couple of quick things, it's also worth pointing out that Awesome Foundation grants can sometimes be extremely competitive. When I started my chapter, I said, oh, I wonder how many applications we're going to get. And in our first 7 months, when it's the first time I tracked data, we had gotten 370 applications, you know, when we were only giving 7 grants out, $1,000 a month at a time. And the other thing is that it's, you know, it sounds really grassroots or whatever, but the caliber of people who are, especially like the Awesome Foundation, you know, in the network, I think it's 4 or 5 TED speakers, you know, published authors, you know, accomplished young technologists out in Seattle. We had Ann Falk is a well-known arts figure in Seattle. The Art Leadership Annual Award is the Ann Falk Award, and she was one of our first trustees. And so looking to, you know, maybe think, and then I've seen giving circles that are more like social justice oriented, and the people who are on those giving circles are, you know, 20, 30, 40 year veterans of local social justice organizing. So if you want to expand the intelligence and capacity to find the new leader and build them up, these are excellent mechanisms. I just wanted to add that.
That's perfect. Yeah. For those of you who know the Grant Craft series, so the Foundation Center helps put out GrantCraft. There's that new version of GrantCraft's document on how do you scan the field and learn about what's going on in a particular subject, whether it's arts or science, whatever the case may be. And we're figuring out that this crowdfunding movement, these small giving circles, are ways to find something that would be completely off the radar of the normal scanning a foundation would do. You go out and talk to nonprofits, you go out to talk to other donors, and you're going to get sort of the same ideas, but we're finding, like the museum project, there's all this sort of innovation coming from other places. And that's one of these sort of terms you're going to hear throughout this kind of process, this unsectored giving or sector agnostic giving. It's finding innovation, finding good ideas, whether it comes from the average person on the street, whether it comes from a nonprofit, whether it comes from a social entrepreneur or a business. The idea is you can find it and then figure out how you seed that into something that nonprofits could do or you can use. And it's really sort of a systems approach in a much more grassroots way, rather than sort of looking from the top, you're looking from the bottom up. And so if you have family members or board members or staff members that are really trying to find, like, where's new information, where's more grassroots innovation, this is a great thing to tap along the way. The other thing we've really learned, at least so far, is, you know, this is obvious probably for most of us. It seems like a very millennial kind of thing to do. It's the way that young people sort of engage with each other and the way they engage with the society, this sort of just very direct action. But it turns out it's also a very entrepreneurial approach. Most of our family foundations were founded by entrepreneurs who took risks to get something done, and they probably didn't pay attention to a lot of rules. They probably didn't, you know, they probably had to fight through some kind of new way of getting something done. Our founders were Alcoa. They were the first ones to find the cheap way to make aluminum, and they had to fight a lot of battles in the scientific community. And so sometimes we get calcified from that entrepreneurial approach to solving problems, and I think this gives us another tool to maybe find some more entrepreneurial DIY grassroots innovation that maybe doesn't sort of happen in our normal nonprofit communities. And even your example in the museum community, there's lots of big nonprofits that we can love to death in universities, but their internal entrepreneurs often get crushed within the strategic planning system. And not that we want to meddle in the strategic planning system, but there's other ways that you can vent that creativity and that cool idea. A teacher may not get something into the budget, but you can fund it through Donors Choose. Something may not happen in a certain park, but IOB can help make it happen as a pilot project. So there's other ways you can get stuff done within your portfolio of what you want to do and sort of edge at a problem from a different route. So we wanted to seed these ideas into you. This is not by all means a comprehensive solution, mostly because there isn't comprehensive information out there yet. We're still sort of plugging it all together. The handout that we have online, there's a couple of examples of the tables, gives you a little bit of a snapshot of some of the information that's there. But we wanted to turn this back over to you. We seeded some things into your heads, and we wanted to put this back into your table conversations and give you 10 or 12 minutes to talk about a couple things. And if I can have Aaron and Nathaniel help hand these out, one per table.
And these are the same?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, there's different variations on them. You need to unwire there.
Okay. Oh, you're right. Thanks for warning.
So if we could get one person at each table to act as a note taker, we've got a couple forms on there. What I did was, if you know the National Council on, or National Center for Family Philanthropy, they have a whole wave of books on excellence in family philanthropy. So we took some of those questions from what does it mean to be an excellent family foundation and put them on these sheets. We'd like you to talk about them at your tables and say, like, what would crowdfunding and giving circles and all of this stuff mean for you in excellence in your grant making, in excellence in involving your next generation, in excellence in your investment portfolio, in excellence in whatever kind of community change you've got? So you have a different set of questions at each table. So if you can get one person to write notes, talk about as many of the questions as you have time for over the next 10 minutes and sort of get your pros and cons. And it's okay if you think it's all negative, put it out there. We want to know. If you think there's positives, we want to hear those. We can collect those and share those with the rest of the field. Are we clear about your assignment? Great. Go for it. For those of you who are listening online, we're going offline for 10 minutes. We are conscious that we only have 60 minutes here, so we're going to pull you out of the conversations that could go on for another half hour.
Do you want to do the raise your hand thing?
Yes.
Plenary?
If you can hear me, raise your hand. My wife was the teacher, not me, so I'm not good at class control. Sorry. So obviously, this is sort of a quick window in and probably sparks some stuff that'll have to continue afterwards. And again, we'll be here afterwards if you want to ask specific questions, and we'll take a couple questions at the end. But let's just go round robin around the tables and get a sense of what question did you talk about most at your table and what were a couple pros and cons that you saw. So let's start where Aaron is, right up here in the front, and we'll work our way back. So what was one of the questions you talked about most?
Can you introduce yourselves, too?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Darren Nordhagen, and our table is a little interesting because we actually only had one family foundation here. The rest of us are all advisors or providers to the philanthropic world, but we obviously know, I think, a decent amount about some of these things. The question we probably spent the most time on was how does this new giving affect involvement of all generations in the grant making of the foundation. And our one, you know, my comment on it was we work with a lot of family foundations, and without a doubt they tell us that if they expect to get the next gen involved in the foundation's activities, they have to meet the next generation where they are. And don't send them a paper board book and ask them to read the grant proposals and then show up prepared to review them at the board meeting. That next generation wants to review proposals online and vote on them, and that's where they consume information. And our one family member here at the table, did confirm that as they're trying to bring on their children into the foundation, get them involved, that they absolutely have expectations of getting things more electronically and
sure.
and seeing things in this new way.
Great. Were there any cons?
That helps. I don't think so. I don't think any of us really did see any cons.
One table converted to love. Next. Right behind you.
I'll do this since I wrote the notes. We really assessed how this would affect.
Can you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Carol Baker, and from a trustee on a family foundation.
Great.
And we talked, and a lot of us at the table were from family foundations, so we talked about how this would affect our grant making. And the plus on it was that it would be great because it would involve younger generations, either currently or for the future, and that it's a very innovative way to approach grant making and takes advantage of leveraging and some of the things that a lot of us do. But the negative was that, or the weakness, is that it also presents problems for some of us around how do you really give that money? Because a lot of us give it to the nonprofit, and those nonprofits aren't always very savvy about taking this or doing a crowdsourcing mm-hmm. Campaign. And so really, don't speak to us, go speak to those nonprofits. And then we'll be happy to give money to have them sort of execute it,
Okay. So it's that sort of legal status issue and the capacity issue.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Ray Richmond with Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, and we had a number of Family Foundation representatives at our table. I think we saw it as a mixed bag, and it really it's a tool that it depends on how you use it and whether it'll be a positive or a negative. When you think about bringing in the next generation, we could definitely see how it would be a benefit to meet people where they are and utilize new tools for communication, but also could be seen as something that would only illuminate the generational divide that exists and sort of upset the older generation to feel like they're being pushed into things that they may not be ready to get pushed into. We also talked about the sort of complexity of funding these kinds of sources and making sure that it's a 501c3, or if not, do you have to do expenditure responsibility, and do you have to get an IRS exemption to give to individuals? And then what about the due diligence, and how are you ensured that people are tracking it? So it can add a level of complexity, but I think we all saw it as a really interesting and useful tool. And just the examples that we heard today helped to illuminate that.
Great. Anything else? Somebody tackled the legal question. I'm so happy.
Hi, I'm Kathy Mutchler with, I'm the Director of Donor Engagement for a community foundation in Wisconsin. So, by the way, I think the weather here is lovely. I think our table spoke about a lot of the same issues you did. We also talked about the legal issues and giving to individuals or not. I think we also felt it was kind of a mixed bag. We saw, it's interesting that you talked about complexity, because we saw this as being a great tool for problems that are not overly complex or that have really simple solutions, but for those here who are working with family foundations who are dealing with pretty complex systems-based solutions, this just didn't seem to be the best tool for that. But we did talk about the value of this as a good source for ideas for solution or for foundations to look at, really good as an effective tool for one-off campaigns or maybe little pieces of bigger campaigns. Mm-hmm. But definitely, a better fit for things that have a finite beginning and an end, and that perhaps are more easily able to explain in very simple language.
Yeah, good point. Good point. You're in the middle.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Linda Leary. I'm with the Rasmussen Family Foundation in Alaska, and I'm new. I'm very new, so I really don't know what I'm talking about, but I will. I'll try. I'll give it a, but I have some great help here. So I think one of the things that stuck out for us, we had a lot of fun talking about the ideas section, and our, I can't remember your name, came from in St. Paul, they have a Minnesota Idea platform that has been pretty successful in allowing them to do you have $1 million grant? A grant to do something similar to what you're doing here with, you know, some of your grants, and it really helped them to kind of complement and expand their focus. And of course, we had a great example here with Michelle and everything that she's doing with the pop-up museum, and the exciting part that she was able to not only grow and share with other people to expand their this museum, pop-up museum idea in other areas of the country. So it's really a cool, innovative area. And from my my business that I run each day too, we're looking for opportunities like this to do with our own employees. So it's really a cool thought, not only on the foundation side, but for those of us that are on boards, that we can take back to our companies too. So.
That's actually a great thought. I've had some friends in corporate philanthropy. I think about it. This is a great engagement tool for small and mid-sized businesses. So if you have a family that has both a foundation and a business, it could be a great employee engagement strategy.
Thank you. I'm Jess Emison. I'm from Pacific Foundation Services in San Francisco. And we work with a group of family foundations in every shape and size, and pretty much ditto to everything. I think we did have a couple points that were really interesting. We talked about the fact that this brings the work of family foundations, which sometimes can feel like off in the distance in a tower somewhere, down to a community level and involving the community in a different way. And then just to sort of echo the due diligence, legality, and all those questions, we were talking about the fact that it'd be interesting to see innovation around accountability in the same way that the giving has expanded and people are kind of, you know, exploring new ways of giving. We'd like to see new ways of sort of accounting for that, echo that, so.
I like it. Well, yeah, somebody who's doing global grant making, so there's this new platform coming online that helps us, so it's gonna be helping us figure out which organizations are expenditure equivalent for global grants. So it's gonna be sort of, yeah. Does anybody know the name of that?
NGO
Source, they're probably here, aren't they?
They are, yeah, they're a table.
Booth number, whatever. Yeah. So, but yeah, like, you know, could some of these platforms help then sort of do that kind of expenditure responsibility for foundations and donor advice funds? That's a really interesting idea, I like that. Okay, so we threw a lot at you at the beginning, and we probably, there are some questions we haven't answered, and they may be like, what the hell are you still talking about questions? A couple people asked, like, okay, so we surfaced the Awesome Foundation, but what is it? So the Awesome Foundation is a network of unincorporated giving circles. There are 50?
So, yeah, it's around 50.
50 of them around the United States, Canada, and around the world. They're started locally by people who want to make their communities, for lack of a better term, more awesome. And the original one was in Boston. There's a website, if you find awesomefoundation.org, it gives you a list of the chapters. The national office is all volunteer as well. But Kel, give you
There's
some resources.
Yeah,
well, yeah, virtual office.
It's really not office.
It's very much that DIY culture they talked about before. But you know, if you're interested in like how could 10 people or 20 people in your community come together with $100 a month and find really cool projects, there's some basic materials out there you can find Nathan or me, and we'll talk to you about it. There's already some out there, and they're happy for folks to find more people who are like Nathan and me, who are sort of playing roles of both traditional philanthropy and this sort of new weird stuff that's going on right now. What other questions?
You can scare them off too, because they're like awesome folks are still learning about philanthropy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so you can teach them philanthropy.
Yeah.
Are there other questions that popped up at your tables? Like, well, we're not sure about this or this. Thanks.
Yes. Hi, Rod Roddenberry from the Roddenberry Foundation. We're pretty new, and I'm not the money guy, so forgive me if I don't say this correctly. But the restrictions in terms of what we can do in terms of a family foundation, we can only give to 501c3 public charities.
You you have the easiest time giving to 501c3
right.
public
so
charities.
Right, so there are ways around it. So yeah. I guess, yeah, so I'd like to hear more about how people, I don't know what Awesome is, I don't know how they're structured, but I'd like to know how someone might be able to do that or how a family foundation could do that.
So we can talk about that afterwards. Okay. If folks are interested, there's a whole thing called legal or expenditure responsibility that private foundations have to do and other foundations have to do, and it involves a bunch of paperwork. And so it does limit some ways that family foundations can engage, but I think there's maybe other ways that you can sort of work through things like IOB. Some of these platforms and groups are 501c3s and some are not. So the easiest way to start it is the ones that are 501c3s. The handout that we have that'll be in the website tomorrow has a list of a few of them that are 501c3s, like Donors Choose and IOB, so it's the easiest way to start into the process.
Yeah. I'd also say, too, fiscal sponsorship is a tool here, so yep. Some people who are crowdfunding or going after microgrants know that, and some platforms help them understand and find their fiscal sponsors. And the Awesome Foundation, there's a sister organization starting called the Institute for Higher Awesome Studies, which should be receiving its C3 letter from the IRS pretty soon. And I don't know if they'll ever be ready to be the fiscal sponsor of Awesome Grantees, but I someday if this advances, it'd be wonderful to have an organization that is an expertise fiscal sponsor organization for small, social giving, grantees, but that's probably a ways down the road.
Yeah, good question. It's a very good basic one. Anybody else?
Hold on, we're recording. You're going to get a mic.
How do you do your due diligence? I mean, how do you know what the other giving circles are doing across the country, and how do you know that they're giving to the organizations that they say they are? Or, I mean, how do you know what's really going on? That's the dinosaur question.
No, that's not a dinosaur question at all. Nathaniel and Aaron can speak more. I mean, in the crowdfunding community, there are now hundreds of platforms. Everybody's trying to glom onto this, and there's, sort of a top 20 or 30 that people are using a lot. So that part of it's a lot more confusing right now. The Giving Circle environment, I think, is a little easier to watch because there's sort of lots of networks of them, and so they're sort of all talking amongst themselves. Like the Community Investment Network is one of them that has, I don't know how many, 30 members or so. I don't remember what the number is. But those folks, sort of find good organizations, and a lot of times their community foundations in their hometowns or other family foundations know them. So you got some sort of relationships amongst the traditional family and traditional philanthropy and donors giving circles more than you do crowdsourcing or crowdfunding right now. So I mean, there's some places in the resource handout that we have. There are some easy places to sort of test, like that groups are going to be pretty good, and then from after that, you have to do some of your more research.
There's a spectrum, too. Some giving circles are actually housed in foundations. Mm-hmm. So one resource there is, for instance, is the Women's Foundation of California, mm-hmm. Women's Foundation of Northern California. I'm sorry, I'm not getting that right. But they're actually, I believe it'll be a public report, too. They're finishing a longitudinal study of like 20 or 30 years of various giving circles. So that's on the institutionally supported side. On the other end of the spectrum are folks who really just want to give money to things and individuals they care about. And they frankly, in Seattle, the way we do it is that we have this liaison from the trustees who goes and writes a blog post about them, and we have that relationship, so they feel very strongly. We have one grantee who did not succeed. I spoke with her recently, and she's like, should we give the fund back? And I said, well, you need to make that decision because we have a relationship. And there's another group, Bread for the Journey. I believe it's breadforthejourney.org, and they are an incorporated network of giving circles. But the executive director there, Mariana Cacciatore, she lives in the Bay Area. She's done some writing. I hope she'll do a little more, really articulating the value in the larger landscape of philanthropy, since most of it does have due diligence and does have accountability measures, that there is a space for really heart-to-heart giving, and trust. And she speaks to that really, really well. And so...
Aaron, you want to talk about briefly how IOB does that due diligence piece?
Yeah, I can. And I think it's actually, what IOB does is actually kind of boring compared to, I think, what's happening on a larger scale. So IOB has a pretty robust performance management framework where we track the results of every single project. And because we do C3 disbursements, we have an opportunity to collect data and results from projects. But I think at a much larger scale, I think that what's happening, there's a really interesting conversation happening around the sharing economy more broadly, and also sort of the new idea of like how millennials are changing the idea of investment and donations, right? And so millennials are like known for like being really pushy and demanding about transparency and where their gifts are going, and like non-accredited investors are getting all this power now. And so I think that, you know, like Michelle has these like 10 people who only gave her $100, but they're gonna be super demanding to make sure that she actually does what she said she does. Even though they only gave her $100 and there's only 10 of them, she feels a personal responsibility towards that. And so it's not a perfect system, it's not a legal tracking system, but I think there is sort of like a built-in way that the sharing economy and these collaborative consumption platforms are forcing people to be beholden to these individuals who they can see their faces online who gave to them.
Back to Nathaniel's earlier conversation, sometimes the due diligence is done for you because everybody else is watching, and you've got more eyes on it than you would have on your own as a family foundation or as a staff. And so, like, oh, I can trust everybody else to say you guys didn't really follow through with your project.
Yeah.
But we are at time. We promised you in our paragraph in the brochure that we would not answer all the questions about this, but we would get an initial conversation going. And we do hope that you follow the three of us on Twitter. Check out Nathan's website, because philanthrogeek.com will become the place where we're going to continue this conversation and blog about what you all talked about and sort of cross-post the audio so people can sort of, if you have other family members that want to listen in and learn about it, we'll cross-post all the documents that we have on there as well.
Who here will be in or near San Francisco on Thursday evening? A few. So there's a small informal PhilanthroGeek launch party in the Mission District. If you're interested, come find me. We'd love to see you there.
Please fill out your evaluations in the conference app, or we've got paper evaluations. You want to stand up, and we've got some paper ones right over here. So thank you so much for your time. We're around the rest of the next half hour if you want to grab us and ask any questions. Thank you so much.